This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Preparing for the next pandemic. I'm Jennifer Kashinka, in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what we have for you this hour. Why the U.S. could be facing another pandemic and what we should be doing about it. Global heat, fire and floods. How much did climate change fuel a hellish July? If you constantly check your phone or tablet during class, it may cost you dearly. And woulda, coulda, shoulda, how to dust off a dream and try again.
My goal in life was to be a songwriter and a singer. But my mother loved Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, and when she heard their song, Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys, she said, this is why I made you become a lawyer and such. So I never got to realize my dream.
Author, veteran, and lawyer Tim Cagle will be here in about 10 minutes with that story. It's been 100 years since the Spanish flu was behind one of history's most devastating pandemics, taking the lives of between 50 and 100 million people around the world. You'd think that we'd be safe from something like that happening again, but members of the bipartisan Blue Ribbon Study Panel on Biodefense says not so. Joining us, the co-chairs of that panel, former Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. Senator Lieberman, we'll start with you. What are examples of some more recent pandemics, and what did we learn from them?
The 1918 Spanish flu pandemic is something most people don't know about, or if they knew about it, they forgot about it. This is the classic. If you don't learn the lessons of history, you're probably going to repeat the mistakes again. And we're moving around a lot more than we used to. People get on planes all the time, travel from one part of the world to the other. An outbreak of an epidemic, an infectious disease, is going to move quickly. One study said that something like the flu vaccine, the flu of 1918, would probably kill 33 million people in 6 months before we could get ahead of it. What are recent examples? Oh, 2002, SARS broke out, cost the global economy over $30 billion. Ebola, the last couple of years, killed thousands of people in Africa. Thankfully, the impact here was not so great, but it still cost at least $10 billion globally. The great fear is of another influenza epidemic that'll move quickly. And that would not only kill a lot of people, it would totally break down our economic strength. And that's why we're meeting business leaders at the Chamber of Commerce, appealing to them to join with government and invest the money now to come up with the universal vaccines, the prevention programs, and better response programs to deal with these biological terrorist threats and infectious disease epidemics before they happen.
Governor Ridge, what kinds of biological threats put the U.S. at greatest risk?
Well, I think there are those that we are about which we are aware. To give you a good example, when I first went into the White House as assistant to the President for Homeland Security, I was given a list of biological threats that we were concerned that were in the hands of either nation states, but at that time might be in the hands of terrorists. One of the items on that list was Ebola. And I was told about this, and in 2001, we had the Ebola outbreak in 2014, and we got lucky. We contained it because of some last-minute dramatic action, and that's precisely the point. If it had been in a larger scale and we not had detected it as early as we did, it could have been a horrible, horrible situation, the repercussions which we'd still be dealing with. So the fact of the matter is that there are multiple risks about which we know. But more importantly, there are multiple risks, particularly around Mother Nature changing the various strains. There are risks around what we call zoonotic diseases that occur within animals that are transmitted to humans, and then as somebody hops on a plane, Well, it could occur in another part of the globe. A couple people with that infected by that disease come to the United States, and all of a sudden it becomes a contagion. And so it's not only what we know, but what we don't know, and how well prepared are we with surveillance, with being able to identify it, with medical countermeasures? How do we incentivize the private sector to do more basic research? It's a fairly lengthy list of things that we need to do over the next couple of years to identify the risk, prepare for the risk. We will never, ever eliminate it. It's like everything else in Homeland Security. You cannot eliminate the threat of a biological incident. You cannot eliminate the threat of flu. But you can be better prepared to reduce its public health impact and its economic impact. And given the fact that we're spending billions of dollars annually, there are over 50 different political appointees that have some kind of jurisdiction, multiple committees of oversight, multiple agencies involved in it, but there's no strategy, there's no plan, there's no unified budget. It's a mess. And if we're serious about dealing with these kinds of risks, and they are real, then we ought to get serious about Congress kind of focusing in on and making the recommendations that are contained within the report.
Senator Lieberman, you talked about money as well and meeting with the business community. What can that community do to help government?
Well, I think the most important early thing that it can do is in the pharmaceutical industry, which is build a partnership with government to really try to develop the kind of universal flu vaccine that I talked about. Beyond that, to get ready, one of the witnesses we're going to have represents the Trade Association of Pharmacies around America. You know, if there's an infectious disease epidemic, people are going to turn to their doctors, but also to their pharmacies. And we want to talk about what the pharmacies of America are doing to get ready for that moment. So private sector in America has tremendous technical expertise, entrepreneurial experience, innovative record, and we need them to focus on this. The market doesn't necessarily reward them for doing that, because if they invest billions in coming up with a universal flu vaccine, they're not sure that people will need it, because they're not sure there'll be a flu outbreak. But honestly, after our research, we are sure there'll be one, and therefore that money will be well spent.
Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut and former Pennsylvania Governor Tom Ridge. It's 13 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Coming up, how to chase your dream at any age. Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal. This business update is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The best place to start or grow your business is at michiganbusiness.org. Contact them today. Ever look back and wonder, why didn't I take that chance? Our next guest tells us it's not too late. Tim Cagle is an Army vet, attorney, musician, and author. Tim, tell us a little about your story.
My goal in life was to be a songwriter and a singer. But my mother loved Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings, and when she heard their song, Mamas Don't Let Your Babies Grow Up to Be Cowboys, she said, this is why I made you become a lawyer and such. So I never got to realize my dream, and then after I passed the bar many years ago, several decades ago, I went to Nashville and took a songbook full of original songs and tried to break into the music industry, but unfortunately it didn't work out. And after a couple of years, I said, I think I'd have much more fun making a living than not making a living. So I came from Nashville, came back to Boston, opened my law practice up again, and I've been there ever since. And I was lucky enough to have a book published last year at the tender age of 71. It's called Whispers from the Silence, and it's a song about country singers and songwriters. So I didn't exactly get my goal, but I modified what I wanted to do, and it turned out even better, I think.
So, Tim, your basic premise is it's never too old to change directions or careers?
Never. Never. I think everything in life can be explained by a song title. And Kris Kristofferson wrote one of the greatest ones. He said, I'd rather be sorry for something I've done than for something I didn't do. So it's never too late, ever.
What if you're not really sure what your dream job is?
Well, then maybe you have to try several things to try to figure it out. I mean, we all have certain interests. We all have things we like and things we don't like. I haven't really had many jobs that I've absolutely loved. I've gotten a lot of satisfaction. I have several, but I know the things that I looked at and I said, boy, I wish I was there. I wish I was on stage. I wish I was doing this. I wish I was doing that. And that gave me an idea of what I wanted to be. How to get there, the pathway sometimes is a little bit different.
We're speaking with Tim Cagle, the author of Whispers from the Silence. Tim, what if you want to make some big change and your family and friends think you're nuts?
Well, I've been a lawyer for many years, and I've had a lot of people think I was nuts, so that's nothing new. You know, family and friends sometimes can have a negative effect on you. You have to listen to your heart. Now, I taught negotiations in the legal context for many years, and there are things called deal points, secondary points, and trade points. So you have to figure out what you want and decide, what am I willing to sacrifice for it? It's called paying the price, and sometimes people say, well, I can't do this and I can't do that. But again, I couldn't be a singer-songwriter, so I wrote a book about being a singer-songwriter.
I would think some of those fears would have to be tied to money, especially if you need money to live and you're giving
Absolutely.
Up some money. How do
but,
you deal with
you
that?
You know, but there's ways to do it. People always, you can find a way. You can find a way to get involved. Now, I don't really play professional anymore or anything, but now I've got two teenage, the daughters of my neighbor. I've been giving them guitar lessons for a few years, and it is an absolute gas to give back to them. I mean, they're 14 and 16. They're in a world that I don't even know about. And it's just so much fun to talk to them and see what's going on in their lives. And they hate my music. They think what I sing is Civil War campfire songs, and they want to listen to Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran. And so I try to teach them that stuff, and once in a while I'll slip in a Sam Cooke song or a John Fogerty song, and they look at me like I've got seven heads, and it's really an absolute blast to deal with them.
Tim, what's next for you? Do you have any more plans to do something different?
Well, Whispers from the Silence, it led to my second book, which is called Unexpected Enemy. And it's the story of a woman who gets the wrong sperm at an infertility clinic and the chaos that ensues from that. So I was lucky enough to have both of those books published by different publishers last year. And so I've got a couple of more books ready to go into production. One, I've got a final manuscript, and I got another one that's pretty much outlined. So I think I'm going to be lucky enough to continue to write books, I hope.
What a personality. Tim Cagle, Army vet, attorney, musician, and author of Whispers from the Silence. It's 22 minutes after the hour on this weekend. Coming up, the impact of global warming on our catastrophic weather. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Global heat, fires, and floods. How much did climate change fuel a hellish month of July? Doyle Rice of USA Today joins us now to tell us what scientists are saying. Doyle, why are heat waves getting worse and more severe?
Well, it's a pretty clear-cut case of global warming causing this. Scientists have known for decades that increased amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere act to warm the atmosphere and the oceans of the world. And it's an obvious sign. It's as one of the scientists I quoted said, it's not rocket science. One of the clearest signs of global warming is extended heat waves. And that's certainly what we saw in late June and throughout much of July across the northern hemisphere, places as far flung as all the way from Finland to Algeria to Oman to Japan and Korea, and even here in the U.S. and Canada saw remarkable, unprecedented heat in July.
And Doyle, we can really back that up with statistics. It's not really something that can be argued about.
At this point, not really. Like for example, I talked to a scientist who said the wildfires in California, which have been making news a lot in the last few days and weeks, about half of the increase in wildfires in California can be linked to climate change. And in addition to we're building where we probably shouldn't be, right there where the wildfires are occurring. But climate does seem to be the driving factor in some of the severity and intensity of those fires.
And Doyle, as it gets hotter and we have more fires at the same time, it's getting wetter.
Yeah, that's one of those odd things, is that it's making the extremes more extreme in both directions, both in terms of some places that are prone to drought, the droughts would be worse, and places that are prone to heavy rain, the heavy rain is getting worse, and the flooding. And there was colossal flooding all over the world in July as well, all across Asia and into parts of Europe, and we had some here in the U.S. as well. And many places in the eastern U.S. had one of their wettest Julys on record.
We're speaking with Doyle Rice of USA Today. Doyle, do scientists think these extreme weather conditions can be attributed to anything other than greenhouse gas buildups?
Well, there are, of course, in any weather event, it's a mix. It's a mix of natural climate phenomena that would be here even if we had never dumped an iota of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And there were heat waves long before we were putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. But it's just the extra oomph that we're supercharging the atmosphere with here, with this extra fuel for heat and for precipitation, it's a pretty clear signal that scientists are actually now able to tease out that the climate change is a factor in many of these extreme weather events now.
And Doyle, when you hear global warmth, it's not just about hotter temperatures, it's just that weather's getting weirder.
Yeah, and there is a factor also that we seem to be a lot more aware of what's going on in previous decades. Everyone now has a smartphone. Everyone is really tied into social media, and we get to see these events in real time almost. That some of this has been occurring before. We just weren't there to document it or to see it. But certainly, when you're looking at some of these records that we're setting, it's not just hearsay. It's definitely you can attribute it to a specific phenomena.
And now we are heading into the heart of hurricane season. So far, it has not been that bad, but in the last few years, the worst has usually come in September and October. What is the big fear this year?
Actually, the trends are for a quieter than certainly quieter than last year, and perhaps even quieter than normal. One of the factors that causes hurricanes to get stronger is a lack of wind shear across the Gulf and the Atlantic. Wind shear acts to rip apart storms before they really can get going, and it's been pretty high this year, almost one of the highest on record. So going into August, we're cautiously optimistic that the hurricane season won't be as bad as it has in the past, as it was last year, which was, of course, probably among the worst, if not the worst, on record. So, keeping our fingers crossed. But as they always say, it only takes one to ruin the season.
Doyle Rice of USA Today. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
We'd like to welcome a new sponsor to the show, Untuck It. You know, it's never a good look when you untuck a long, bulky dress shirt. Untuck It makes shirts specifically designed to be worn untucked. A casual shirt that's not too long and not too short. It's just right. And not only do they look good, they feel great. And if you're a woman, by the way, wishing you can have one of these, well, Untuck It now makes shirts for women, too. Log on to untuckit.com and check out all the new arrivals. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% off your entire purchase. You can also visit one of Untuck It's over 25 retail locations across the country. Untuckit.com, your solution to perfecting casual. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings. Again, untuckit.com and use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings.
Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal coming up on This Weekend. Why checking your phone or tablet during class can affect your grades, hiring a coach to boost your kids' video game scores, and the identical twins who married identical twins. That story in about 20 minutes. Our personal data are collected in numerous ways these days, from Instagram clicks to fitness apps. While many of those efforts are aimed at adults, more are targeting students. Natasha Singer of the New York Times is here with more. Natasha, your story profiles a group of students who had taken a college planning questionnaire. What happened here?
As you know, high school students all across the United States are filling out all kinds of surveys to get information about colleges. They take surveys before the SAT or the ACT tests, but also schools have surveys called things like mycollegeoptions.com. And students fill them out and give their personal information, their age, their home address, their family income, what their religious leanings are, so that, you know, they might hear from religious colleges. And it turns out that in many cases, the data is sold not just to the colleges who want to contact you, but it can be sold to for-profit groups, student loan companies, financial services. And in the case of my story, we found that students' names were bought by a kind of science event, and they were sent these letters, these teenagers, that said, you know, "Dear Billy, you have been selected for a nationally recognized program for superior high school students in science and technology," inviting them to this fancy thing that would cost their parents $985. And the students thought, wow, you know, I've been selected for this honor. And they did all have good grades, but they were selected because they'd filled out mycollegeoptions.com and their data had been bought and shared.
Wow. Is all this perfectly legal?
That's a great question. So there is no law that regulates data brokers. That means like consumer companies that collect your data, you know, your sweepstakes data, your voting data, your how much you spent on your house or have a mortgage data. There's no regulation for consumer data brokers. There are federal education privacy laws, but those only apply to public schools and how they share students' data. So, for example, if a school wants to share personal data from a student's education record with another entity, you know, let's even say a school bus company, right? They're allowed to do that under certain exceptions because, like, the school bus company is performing a school function. But for other things, public schools need permission from parents to share this information. The problem is that the law regulates the schools, not the entities they share the data with, and some of those entities are passing on students' data to other companies.
We're speaking with Natasha Singer of the New York Times. Natasha, I would think that some parents would be just in an uproar over this. Is anyone pushing back?
Well, one of the reasons we did the story is that we'd heard from parents whose kids were invited to some of these fancy-sounding programs. And the parents were upset for a number of reasons. One is they felt that these educational programs were predatory and marketing to the students, right? And the students come and say, "Mom, I've won this fabulous award, and it's only going to cost $1,200 or whatever for me to go." And so that puts the parents in a bad position, that having to say to the kid, actually, you know, this is like Publisher's Clearinghouse, right? It's like a marketing brochure. You actually haven't won something, even though you're a great student. So the parents were upset about the way the students were being marketed to, but also that their home address and the student's GPA and various other things had been sold.
So, Natasha, if you had a teenager or someone in school and they were faced with these kinds of questionnaires as a parent, would you tell them just don't fill these out?
I think it depends on what the survey is. I mean, I think if it's the ACT and they're only going to sell your child's data to colleges, universities, and scholarship organizations, you probably want your child to hear from colleges, universities, and scholarship organizations. And any family that's gone through this process and whose child has filled out a survey, you know, you're getting dozens, perhaps hundreds of things in the mail all the time. And you may think that's junk mail, but there may be some stuff in there from colleges you do want to hear from. So I would say that, you know, that can be useful. I think some of the stuff, like mycollegeoptions.com, that kids are doing in their schools that says, you know, in their privacy policy that they could share your data with a student loan organization or a travel program or a summer camp. If I were a parent, I would think about that twice.
Natasha Singer of the New York Times. It's 21 minutes before the hour on This Weekend. Coming up, why you shouldn't constantly check your device in class. Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Well, if you're constantly checking your phone or laptop during class, it may hurt you. MarketWatch's Maria LaMagna has that story and joins us now. Maria, what's wrong with checking your devices during class?
So in this, you know, recent research, the researchers actually divided students up into two groups and allowed them to use devices like laptops and phones and tablets during some school lectures and not in others. And what they found was that students actually performed pretty well when they gave them quizzes at the end of a class, even if they did have their devices with them. But the twist was, you know, when it came to actually retaining that information longer term and seeing if they could answer those same questions on a final exam, they actually performed worse. So their takeaway was, you know, maybe in the shorter term, you might not notice that checking your device is impacting you, but when it comes to the longer term retention, it actually does catch up with you then.
It's kind of a scary thing because I would think in high school they don't allow as much of the devices to be used, but college certainly, a lot of people are taking notes on laptops and doing nothing
yes.
but looking at devices.
Exactly. And, you know, that in and of itself isn't a bad thing, but it just so tempting to click over onto another tab and, you know, sort of multitask. And that's basically what the researchers wanted to see, is that is multitasking really throwing you off with those devices? So if you're able to stay super, super focused and use your device solely for taking notes, you know, that's different from letting yourself sort of drift over and check other apps and get distracted.
What if you are surrounded by people who are doing that and you're trying very hard to listen to the lecture?
Totally. So that's actually something interesting. I thought in this study, they did look at students who didn't use the devices themselves, but were present in a classroom where other people were, and they were just as impacted by other people using them as they would be if they were doing that themselves. So it's really distracting for them to see, you know, two students laughing about something, or, you know, even just catching glimpses of what people are looking at. It's distracting enough to kind of throw off their learning enough to actually catch up with them on the final exam.
We're speaking with Maria Lamagna of MarketWatch. I wonder if students realize this and if there's anything they can do about it.
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, trying to limit the distractions for yourself is probably the best thing you can do. And when it comes to what other people are doing, you know, maybe find a spot in a classroom where you aren't looking at other people's shoulders, if that's possible, you know, whether that means sitting in the front row or way over to the side or something like that. But it is hard, you know, obviously in today's day and age, everyone has their devices out pretty much all the time. So it is difficult. But I think limiting your own use as much as you can is probably the easiest thing you can do.
Maria, how does research like this in a classroom translate into the work arena?
So very much the same. Previous studies have shown that people check their phone about every 15 minutes, which is so much. And, you know, once you actually check, it takes about 20 minutes to return to the task that you were working on. So it's, you know, when you think about that and how much we're checking and then how much time it takes to get back focused, there really are similar takeaways for the work environment, because, you know, not only might you not be doing as good of a job while you multitask, but now we know it could also impact what you're learning longer term in your own role.
Market Watch's Maria Lamagna. It's 14 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Coming up, why some parents are hiring video game coaches for their kids.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal. You've heard of parents paying for music lessons for their kids, or maybe tennis lessons, but video game lessons? As Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal tells us, that's where we are now. Sarah, why in the world would parents hire someone to help their kids win video games?
You know, video games have become so popular and so much more mainstream over the years that they've sort of become a social proving ground, and that's especially the case with Fortnite, which is particularly popular at the moment. It has 125 million people playing it worldwide, according to the company that created it. And so parents are looking at this as an opportunity to help their kids maybe gain an edge, get some bragging rights, maybe deal with some peer pressure. And also it's just an opportunity for them to bond with their children through something that the kids really like.
Did adults in the past get help with video games?
Yeah, video game coaching is something that's been around for many years. The difference is that in the past, the people paying for it were mostly, you know, adults, hobbyists, who just wanted to get better at a game, or they were older teenagers who saw a potential future as a professional gamer, which is, you know, right after high school, it's very common for esports players to try and go pro. Some of them do go to school. In fact, some of the colleges now have varsity esports teams. But we haven't in the past seen cases where parents are calling up services and hiring coaches for children in the middle school and even the elementary school age range.
If I were a parent and wanted to find a coach for my kid, what would I do?
Well, there are some services out there like Gamer Sensei, and that's in the U.S., and Bidvine in England, that contract out coaches. There are a couple smaller ones that are independent that you can find online just by doing a simple Google search. And some people have put out requests on social media saying, I'm looking for a coach, or some coaches put out messages on social media saying, hey, I offer this, message me if you're interested. There are also a number of professional esports players who do coaching on the side and may promote themselves, like I said, through social media and let people know that they're available.
Speaking with Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal, Sarah, what kind of dollars are we talking about if we want to coach for our kids?
Well, the prices range. If you look at some of the sites, these are contractors, so they name their own prices. And mostly what I've seen is pretty low, in the $10 to $25 an hour range.
In talking to some of the parents who have done this for your story, are they glad that they did it?
Oh, absolutely. They love it. They think that's making their children happier. And in some cases, they're enjoying it themselves because they've been wanting to get better at the game to keep up with their children, and they find it enjoyable, and it's a great way for them to bond.
Sarah, I read some comments on your story. One of them was kind of funny. It said, the good news is that parents are involved. The bad news is that parents are involved. Is there a downside to this?
You know, that's really an opinion that I'm not going to really, you know, weigh in on my own personal preferences, but I know that a lot of parents, they think it's fine as long as their children are, you know, keeping up their grades in school and participating in other activities. And all the parents I spoke to said that was the case. They said they had hired coaches for their kids for swim lessons or piano, and that their kids are not, you know, hiding out in a basement and gaining weight and hiding, shutting them out from the rest of the world. That's not the case at all.
And Sarah, you talked about it earlier, the success and popularity of Fortnite and the success and popularity of esports. Does that mean that this is just going to continue to get bigger and bigger?
Well, it's hard to say. Some games, their popularity fades after peaking at a certain point. We haven't quite seen that yet with Fortnite. It seems to be still going strong when you look at, for example, viewership statistics on Twitch, which is a site where people, broadcast themselves playing video games and talking about it.
Sarah Needleman of the Wall Street Journal. It's 7 minutes before the hour on this weekend. Coming up, a couple of marriages made in twin heaven. Two sets of 24-year-old identical twins who had their first date together and became engaged at the same time are tying the knot in Michigan this weekend before living together in a two-bedroom apartment. Identical twins Cassie and Chrissy Bevier from Michigan Center are marrying Zach and Nick Lewin from White Lake. The two sets of twins met at Grand Valley State University 4 years ago in a psychology class. The twins recalled the professor asking the class if there were any twins in attendance. A bunch of hands went up, and following class, the twins exchanged numbers. Cassie and Nick had their first date at church one Sunday morning. They also invited Chrissy and Zach to tag along, and soon they, too, started to date. Last year, Nick and Zach Lewin proposed to the Bevier sisters on a trip to the Henry Ford Museum in Dearborn. The brothers said they did not plan to propose at the same time, but it just happened. Cassie, meanwhile, claims the four of them don't go everywhere together, but 90% of their dates turn into double dates. Following their wedding, the couples plan to move in together into a two-bedroom apartment in Fenton. But first, a relative gift to the couples with a stay at their house in Florida. Both couples say they will go on their own for a few days apart, but go to Disney World together. For Gordon Deal, I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.